Hi, I'm Lisa Feigenbaum, and I'm a program manager on the Microsoft Visual Basic team. I'm here today with Lucian Wyszyk. Lucian, you want to talk about your background on the VB team and what your current role is today?
Sure. I've been on the VB team for a year and a half. I've recently been appointed VB spec lead. Paul Vick, the previous principal architect for VB, is leaving, and I'll be taking over his duties. I've been working on a lot of Dev 10 features for the next release of Visual Basic, and that's what we'll be demoing today.
Great. So we're going to take a look at VB 10, lots of demos. Lucian, why don't you show us what's new?
Thanks, Lisa. Let's start up here with a simple program. It creates an array of integers called scores. It starts a separate thread, and it passes address of print scores, and that's the routine that this thread is going to execute. If we look at the implementation of the routine, it just goes through the scores and prints them out to the console. The first new feature that I'm going to talk about is multi-line statement lambdas. What we can do is we can take the body of this function that we used to have to pass as an address of and put it right inside the argument itself. That makes it a lot easier. It means that you're not creating separate functions for every single work that you have to do. You can keep it in line in the same places in the code as where you want it. It also means that we don't have to do any of that C-type business, because right here, inside the body of this sub, the compiler can infer that the variable O is an integer, because it knows what type scores has.
Looks really similar to subs that you have, you know, any other sub that you have in your program that's not in line.
I think so, yeah. And, I mean, like we normally have subs, we can also define functions. I've written a small inline function. This is like a lambda. I mean, it is a lambda, but it's got multiple lines. It's got quite a simple body. If the argument is bigger than 10, snap it up to 100, otherwise return 5. If I hover over the function f, you can see that it's inferred the return type of the function as an integer. What we can also do, just like a normal function, is we can explicitly declare the return type. Here we've said that this function f will return a double, and then it will cast all of the return types into that double.
What's the case when you might want to do that rather than just using the regular type inference?
I think there aren't any cases, to be frank. I think the type inference is such a powerful feature that everyone should be using it a lot. The cases where you might not are just where you want to be absolutely careful and precise. Maybe you've had a spec written which says which types are returned, and make sure that everything is at that correct type.
Okay.
Now, here with the statement lambdas, we created one giant thread which printed all of the scores in parallel. I want to show you another neat feature of Visual Studio 2010. scores.asParallel. What we're doing here is we're using the new plink library that's coming out of Microsoft. Parallel FX, it's also called. Plink is an attempt at making parallel programming easier, very much easier to write in certain circumstances. What we've done here is we've set scores.asParallel, and that means that what comes after it will be executed in parallel. We executed the forAll statement, and again, we passed one of these statement lambdas inside. Sub I, it knows that I is an integer, because scores was an array of integer, and all it does is print it. And if I execute this code, we we can see that actually it's changed the order around. It really was executing it in parallel. It means that 60 happened to be done first, then 70, 80, 90, then 10 came next. I think this shows two striking things about P-Link. The first is that it's really easy to use. The second is that it's very easy to misuse. Some contexts really are not appropriate for parallelization. In this case, if we expected them all to be output to the console in the original order, then P-Link would not have been the best place to do it.
What are some places you would recommend it?
The places I'd recommend to it is every time where we think that the operation we're doing has no side effects, or at least it has side effects where the order we don't care about. I think lots of link statements, link constructs we do actually are quite good candidates for it. Here's one. A simple link statement, it goes through all of the scores, it goes through them in parallel. It selects out the scores that are greater than 50. Now, the body of this code is so tiny and the array is so tiny that it doesn't, parallelization doesn't matter in this case. But you can imagine that if you had 10,000 elements in the array, it really would help. It might as well be done in parallel, and here we can do it in parallel. So, P-Link being used both with the for all and passing it as sub, but also P-Link very easy to use with the familiar link syntax from Visual Basic 9.
It's interesting, it looks like the statement lambda syntax is a little bit different whether you're using multi-line or in the second example where you did a single line. So you no longer need to use the end sub in that second example.
Yes. We can use both of them if we want. And a sub that's all on one line is exactly equivalent to a sub that contains only a single line in its body.
Great, well, what else?
Well, since we've got these arrays on hand, I'm going to go straight into DLR interop, interop with IronPython. Let's drag a piece of code from the toolbox. Interop with the dynamic language runtime, and in this case, interop with Python. What the code does here is it creates a new Python engine object. It tells it which search paths to look on for the Python libraries. And this statement here says python.useFileOfRandom.py. What that's going to do is load random.py. It's part of the Python standard library. And the result of loading it is a module object. This module object contains one shared method for every function that was defined in the Python file. And here I'm going to invoke it with, I'm going to invoke one of the methods called shuffle that was implemented in Python. It's part of the standard library, but it can operate on .NET integer arrays just fine without trouble. Let's put some print statements. And we'll run this. And what we'll expect to see is that Python should have shuffled the array.
Cool.
And that's, sorry, it took me a moment just to realize that it had indeed shuffled it, 20, 30, 60. Yes. So, Python interop. I should give a caveat. I'm using newer bits than the virtual PCs you might have downloaded. The Python interop is not available yet on the CTP. It will come out later.
Right. You want to explain what the DLR is and why we're interoping with Python now?
Good question. The DLR is Microsoft's new major effort into dynamic languages, Python, Ruby. And the idea is that the DLR, the dynamic language runtime, is going to sit on top of the CLR. Okay. All of Microsoft's new dynamic languages are going to target the DLR. It creates dynamic objects that Python programmers will be familiar with. And I think the idea here is that the future of languages is heterogeneity. We're going to be using Python for the things that are done best in Python. We're going to be using VB for the things that are done best in VB. And we really want to be able to talk between them neatly. This is our solution.
So some cases where you might choose to use a dynamic language as opposed to VB might be?
I think Python has got a really tremendous and a very large library of standard things.
That's true.
It stands in parallel to the one that .NET provides. It provides some useful things. And for high-level scripting, Python is really excellent. There's a lot of body of code also using standard Python libraries, beautiful soup for scraping HTML. Yes.
I think dynamic languages also, if you're working with some interfaces where types might be changing, that dynamic languages are a little bit more lenient in that respect. They're better for working with places where you have an application that might be accessing data over the web, and maybe the response that you're getting back might be changing. A dynamic language might be ideal for that kind of scenario.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah,
I want to head on to some more features.
Sure.
In the set search paths function, you can see that we passed an array of strings. And we had to construct the array, at least in Visual Basic 9, by writing new string array and then passing it. A new feature we've put in for Visual Basic 10 is that you don't need to write that. You just write the array directly, and it figures out that you intended an array of strings.
That's so logical. It's funny that we didn't have that before.
Here's another example. When we declared scores, we don't need to say that it's an integer array. We can just write it directly, and the compiler infers that it is an array of integer. This type inference thing, I think, is really neat. Let's try tricking it by putting a double in there. So we have an array literal which contains integers and doubles. What is it going to infer for the type? It's going to infer that it's a double array because it contains both integers and doubles, and double is the only type that makes sense to contain both of these. The feature is called array literals. Let's try and really trick it. We'll stick a string in there. You might wonder, what type is it going to infer if it's got integers and doubles and strings? The answer is a warning. Cannot infer an element type because more than one type is possible. Object assumed. And we see that scores really is an array of objects.
This feature looks really powerful for this first scenario that you used it where you're passing in an argument to a function, which is very concise.
Absolutely. I've been using it all of the time now since it was introduced into the code base. I'm going to show you some other neat ways of using it. Here I've created a simple 2x2 matrix, an identity matrix. If we hover over this, it has inferred that it is a two-dimensional array. So array literals also working with higher dimensions. Now we'll try with the jagged array. This hasn't worked. It put an error message under here. It said array initializer is missing three elements. What it's done here is it's figured out the user probably meant to do a multi-dimensional array and forgot to fill in the missing elements. So the syntax we use to create a jagged array is we put in some parentheses around the jags. If we hover over this, right, it's inferred that jagged really is an array of arrays of integer.
If in doubt, parentheses is probably a good thing to use in the Visual Basic language. They're everywhere.
Sounds advice, Lisa. Let's get rid of some of this, and I'm going to show you some more features. The thing is that, I mean, arrays are great. As you said, the prime use case is passing arrays to a function. But a lot of the time, you're going to want to use the real data structures like lists. And if you want to populate this list, you have to manually call scores.add every single time. what we did was look at this and think, well, writing add three times is kind of tedious. Let's add a new syntax that we call collection initializers. What this syntax is the from keyword, and it's exactly equivalent to calling scores.add three times, one on each of the elements.
So if you leave that right now, is that going to add six elements?
I think it will add six elements. Let's just run it to see. Yes, okay. It's added six elements, the first three and the original three. So let's delete those redundant ones.
It's a lot more concise.
I think so. Now watch this. Scores has a new, not a list, but a dictionary. Remember what we said, that the collection initializer syntax with the from keyword just calls add several times, one for each thing that's in here. A dictionary has an add method, and so it's going to call the dictionary add method twice. First, passing it a new key Bart, value 53, and next, creating a new key called Lisa, which a new value of, sorry, Lisa's super smart, 99. And if we run that, it's created the dictionary correctly.
It's really similar to the object initializer syntax, which we had in BB9. Basically, if you had a with instead of that from, it's a similar concept.
I think so. The whole story is making it easier to do the common pattern that you want to do with the array, isn't it? Or the data structure. Let's try something a bit more powerful. Dim scores as new list of student. Student is a class I defined down here. I said a student is a class, it inherits from business object, and it's got a property called score. Of course, it's got the additional properties that it inherited from business object. This property score is an integer. And we've written this completely standard boilerplate code, a getter and a setter for the property. And what we thought was, it's all boilerplate. Let's have the compiler generate it automatically. The deal here is, if you write a property and you don't provide getters and setters yourself, then the compiler provides them itself for you. We call this feature auto properties. I'm going to do some more of them. Here was this business object. It created the backing fields called underscore ID, underscore name, and then it created the property. When it has the auto property, it uses a backing field of the same name, underscore ID. So we can delete the backing fields.
I sense a common theme here. So when you say BB10 will reduce the number of lines of code in your app, so fewer lines to maintain, fewer bugs.
Absolutely. Okay, so we've done these auto properties, and let's try and use them. Right up here we had scores as new list of student, scores.add of new student with.id equals 101. Name equals Bart.score equals 53. At this point you might look at it and think, he's calling scores.add. He doesn't need to do that. He could use the collection initializer syntax. And I'm going to do that, except I'm going to do it in a slightly cunning way. I'm going to create an extension method so that I don't need to type out this new student with every single time. See how that works. Get some empty space down here. Stick in the extension method. This is an extension method. Let's wrap the line so we can see them more clearly. Extension methods were introduced into VB9. This extension method is on list of students. So whenever we call, we have a variable like scores, which is a list of students, and we do scores.add, it's going to come straight through to this function, a us provide the implementation of it. Now, this is great, because what we can do is we can go back to the scores student.add statement, and we can turn it into a collection initializer. And we don't need to write the add statements at all. Now, as you said, this is really a lot shorter. Let's execute the code. And it's created a list of three students.
So what's going on here under the hammer? So add is still being called?
Add is still being called for each time. The first time, it calls it first. Add with 101, Bart 53. It calls it a second time with add 102, Lisa 99. And each time it's calling add, it's invoking this add method.
Okay.
Actually, looking at this, every single VB customer has looked at these underscores, these line continuation characters, and has thought they looked really ugly. So what we've done for Dev 10 is let you delete them at long, long last.
Wow.
Actually, I'm going to go crazy. I'm going to delete them from over here as well. We can delete them in pretty much all places that we came across where it was useful to delete them. Not in every single case. It's keyed to the common places after a comma, after a binary operator. Pretty much every time where you want to break a line without a line continuation character, you now can.
Why did that take so long? That seems like such a sensible thing to do with the language.
I think that's what every single one of our customers was saying as well. Let's go to something a bit fancier. We're not just going to print the scores out to the console. Let's find some more space here. We're going to do some HTML literals. I created this function called bobs to HTML. It takes in a list of business objects and it returns a X element. In fact, what it returns is an HTML table. I love these XML literals from VB9. They're just so powerful.
Yeah, and you can probably even take out those line continuations now.
Good point. This was a link query, and we can take out line continuations. What it's doing is, for each business object that was in a list of business objects, it's constructing a table row in HTML, and each table row contains one table column, which has got an image, and I've given its source name constructed from the business object name, and it prints out the ID. And then let's invoke it. Dim HTML equals bobs to HTML of scores. And this should construct our list of students into the HTML table element. But there's an error here. And this error, I think, is one that about, 100% of our customers have run into, and 50% of them have written into us to complain about it. What the error tooltip is saying, I'm sorry, the tooltip is quite long, just so it can be completely explicit. It's saying that a list of students cannot be converted to a list of business objects. Instead, consider using an IEnumerable of business objects.
Using options strict off, that's not something you really see in many other places in the Visual Basic language. It's usually pretty lenient about conversions that you're going to do.
That's right. Options strict off is pretty lenient. In this case, actually, what it's doing is it's saying, no matter that options strict off, I know that a list of business objects can never be converted to a list of... A list of students can never be converted to a list of business object. So it's given the error in any case. Let's do what it says. Let's change the target from list to IEnumerable. And the error goes away. We call this feature variance. And what we've seen here is that actually an IEnumerable of student can be converted to an IEnumerable of business object. I'm thinking I shouldn't have called them business objects. Students are not business objects, they're people. I'll call them people from now on. Now, I should also say that this variance feature hasn't made it into the CTP release. I had to improvise by implementing my own enumerable rather than using the one that's provided in the BCL. Of course, when Dev 10 is released, IEnumerable will be made into a proper variant object. And you can use this variance feature yourself. If you, when you declare any of your classes, IEnumerable was declared as an interface IEnumerable of T. The change we've made is to call it IEnumerable of out T. And this out keyword is what allows the variance to kick in.
So from all those folks who wrote in, what were some of the scenarios where people were running into this?
Actually, it was precisely this one. They've got the general business object class, and they've got a derived thing, a customer, a supplier, anything like that. And they really wanted to be able to convert to them, and they've never been able to.
So how would people work around that?
It was awful. What they used to have to do in the past was call scores.cast of business object. Oops. Equals scores.cast of business object. And what that was doing was on every single element of the original list of business objects, it was performing a runtime cast, and of course runtime casts are expensive, and it's kind of bad that we have to do it on every single one of those elements. The variance feature, in fact, takes zero time at all. It's completely free from the CLR perspective.
So how does the new feature work?
You know,
is
Lisa,
basically taken care of by the CLR?
I'm going to pass on that because variance is a really difficult feature to get your heads around. So what we've done is we can read up the blogs and documentation to find out where precisely it works and how to use it in your code. The neatest way to use variance, actually, is to just do the stuff that obviously should work but didn't work in AUKUS, and either it's going to work immediately for you, or, as we saw here, it's going to put up an error message that indicates to you what you should be doing, saying you should use IEnumerable, or it's going to, in most scenarios, it's going to say, hey, this hasn't worked, but if you put in the out keyword, then it would work.
Okay. Should we run that and see it working?
Let's run it. Just put a print statement to show the HTML that it's produced. And it's produced the HTML table. Actually, we can go one step better. Let's not print to a console. I'm going to do some word interop here. We're using the standard word interop features, creating a new interop object, creating a new document on it, copying the HTML to the table, and pasting what we've copied onto the clipboard, this HTML table, into the Word document. Actually, I filled it out with all of the optional and parameters, and of course they're not needed. And they've never been needed in Visual Basic. Now let's run that.
Where did those images come from?
There we have it. The images came from in the bobs to HTML. When it constructed the HTML literal, it took the name of each element, it appended .jpg to it, and then it embedded an image source tag, and I just happened to have lying around some images of the appropriate name in my binaries directory. Actually, what this interop has done is that it's embedded a reference. We've used a reference to Microsoft.com office.interop.word. And whenever we deploy our solution, we have to make sure that that interop assembly has been deployed to the customer's machine. It's kind of a pain, you know. I'm going to fire up Reflector to examine the binary that we've produced. And right there, it's got the reference to the interop assembly. The interop assemblies are quite large. They're a pain to deploy. And so we've got a feature, which means that you no longer have to deploy them. This feature is called NoPIA, No Primary Interop Assembly. And the way we activate it is we go to the reference, go to properties. At the moment, it says embed interop types is false. We're going to change that to true. If we rebuild our solution and run Reflector again, there is no reference anymore to the primary interop assembly. You don't need to deploy that to your customers' machines.
It's pretty easy to enable.
It's easy to enable. And the reason there isn't an assembly is that we've embedded the interop types straight inside the console application that we've produced. Let's have a look
at that. Is that going to make my application very large?
Right, you're thinking that the interop assembly was several megabytes big.
Right.
Actually, no, it's not. All that we've done is we've copied out only those functions, the methods, the properties, the classes that we're actually going to use in the code. As we saw, we only used document and selection and visible. Those are the only properties that have been copied into our executable. It's only got this paste special method. So in fact, the impact on your application is typically quite tiny. As we know, the interop assembly is 99% full of functions that 99% of our users don't end up using. There we have it. This is a run-through of the key new features for Visual Basic 10. As we've said, two of them aren't available on the CTP bits that you've had, the variants and the Python interop. They will, of course, be present in the release of Visual Studio 10. What have we done? We've talked about array literals, dynamic language interop, the future of Microsoft's dynamic story, interop with Python, interop with Word. We talked about collection initializers, and we talked about
auto properties,
and line continuation characters, my favorite.
Great, well, we look forward to trying them out in the CDP. Thanks, Lucian.
Thanks, Lisa.